in 3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast at the New Republic, episode 11. Grierson, what year will we get in the forever series that is Star Wars now? What year are we looking at episode 11? Will we be in our 50s? This is my official question for you, Grierson. Will we be in our 50s when episode 11 of Star Wars comes?
It's possible. I think it entirely depends on how 8 and 9 do, which I'm sure they'll do great.
I don't think they're shutting that down.
I think it's just a question of if they want to continue going forward or if they're going to expand and go sideways with side characters and things like that.
Well, all I know is this, what we've all been saying now, would make a terrific opening crawl. All of our podcast should have a crawl to start, I think, clearly. Why are we just talking rather than having a crawl? I know why we're talking, because we're supposed to intro the podcast. This is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 11, on the New Republic. We remind you, as always, to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a nice review on iTunes, and with a movie at the end, and we will review your movie. Two of the movies that we will be doing this week came from that. They are Shattered Glass from 2003, about a journalism scandal at a publication, the name of which I cannot recall at the moment. And Shotgun Stories, which is directed by Jeff Nichols. We'll be talking about both of those later on. But please subscribe to us on iTunes. Please find us on SoundCloud or thenewrepublic.com. Also, find us on Twitter at Grierson Leach and email us griersonleach@newrepublic.com. Now, this week, the big movie opening this week was Everybody Wants Some! ! From Richard Linklater. So what we're going to do, because Tim and I have been, we've been doing this for a long time, and I really do not want to know what Tim has thought of the movie. It's very important for me not to know what he thought of this movie. Like when he promoted the review that he wrote up this from our Twitter, he wrote the tweet himself. He has seen his review. I have not. I do not know his letter grade. I want that continue to be the case until I actually see the movie. So what we're going to do is Tim is going to soliloquy on us about Everybody Wants Some. And then we record this through Skype. So he's going to send me a little note and let me know when he's done. I'm going to put my headphones back on. So therefore, you, listener, will know what Grierson thinks of Everybody Wants Some. And I, who is co-hosting the podcast with him, will not. This is are the links that we are willing to go to make sure they do not find out what Grierson thinks of Everybody Wants Some. Okay, I take my leave of you now. Godspeed to you, listeners.
This ain't high school, man. You're at a new level here. Have not earned teammate status yet.
Who the hell are you?
Oh, Jake Bradford.
And until you do, you're nobody.
I'd like to introduce you to the new guys. Two rules: no booze in this house. Number two: no girls upstairs in those bedrooms.
I'm seriously worried about these new guys.
Will, are you gone? Okay, it's just us listeners. So yes, Everybody Wants Some opened, I think, only in LA and New York this weekend, and it's the new film from Richard Linklater. He has referred to it as a spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. I have not seen Dazed and Confused in, God, maybe at least 15 years. If there are connections to Dazed and Confused in terms of the characters like that, I completely missed it. And so I say that to say that if you have not seen that movie or have never seen it or it's been a long time, do not worry. You can go into Everybody Wants Some and enjoy it just fine on its own. It's set in 1980 in a small college town in Texas where the action is set on the baseball team. At the school, they're sort of an elite baseball team. They're sort of one of the best in the state. And it's sort of an ensemble piece, and you meet a lot of the baseball players who all live together in the same housing off campus. But most of the action is focused around a freshman pitcher named Jake, who's played by Blake Jenner. People who watch Glee remember Blake Jenner from that show. I did not watch Glee, so he is a new face for me, and I really found him very appealing, just as I did everybody else in this movie. And in sort of typical Linklater fashion, not unlike Dazed and Confused, there is not a lot of plot that happens in this movie. Essentially, the movie is set over the 3 days right before fall semester begins, and you just get to hang out with the baseball players as they go to parties, meet women, try to get laid, you know, basically just kind of screw around, sort of shoot the breeze at their house, drink beer, smoke pot, listen to music. It's really sort of a classic hangout movie in that way. And because the baseball season for them doesn't start till spring semester, they're not even really playing baseball all that much. They really are just hanging out. And what I think is really interesting about the movie is that it sets up the scenario of these guys in 1980 who live in Texas. Almost all of them are white. There's only one black player on the team. And they're really just jocks. I mean, this is not a movie where one guy, writes poetry or this other guy has this like amazing, depth to him. They really are just athletes. They're just kind of fun-loving, looking to get laid, heterosexual jocks. And what I think is really great about the movie is that the movie in some ways sets you up to think, oh God, I'm going to be stuck in a movie with a bunch of bros talking about getting laid, talking about chicks, and how to score with them and things like that. But what the movie does really well is after sort of setting that up, the movie kind of goes in these really kind of interesting directions. And again, everybody in the movie that you meet, whether it's the upperclassmen who have real pro prospects, they have a real chance of actually becoming professional ball players, and some other people who this is kind of the end of the road for them. And they kind of know that after college, maybe they'll play baseball for a couple of years professionally, maybe in the minors, but that's kind of the end for them. You learn more about these guys and you really get to like them. But at the same time, Linklater never lets them stop being jocks. And I mean that actually in a good way, because I think what the movie does really well is it doesn't pretend that these guys are somehow deep thinkers or so dimensional that this whole time we didn't realize that there was so much more to them. They really are just baseball players. They really are just guys who are kind of kings on campus, who really, really just want to have sex with as many women as they possibly can. And I think that's a good thing for the movie, because I think what Linklater does in this movie, like he's done in his other films, whether it's Boyhood or his Before trilogy, is that he just shows people as they are and kind of just lets them be themselves. And that's enough, because these guys, though they are just sort of jocks, are really funny and really interesting, and they have real feelings and they have insecurities. And those start to kind of slowly come out. And at the same time, because there isn't a lot of plot in the movie, it's not as if there's some big scene or big catharsis that happens. It's always kind of like literally kind of tiny, small moments. In my review for The New Republic, what I mentioned is that the thing that's always so tough for people like me who are big Richard Linklater fans is if you kind of rave about it to your friends and say, oh, you have to see Everybody Wants Some, the problem becomes it gets blown up in other people's minds about how great this movie is. And then they go see it and they think, well, it's just dudes hanging out. What's so special? And I think what's so special about this movie is how kind of small and modest, but how wise and perceptive it is, especially about what it's like to be in college. It's been a long time for me since I've been in college. But one of the things I really kind of remember when I go back to campus now, to my old school, I see like freshmen and sophomores, and they have that look on their face where they know that they're in college and they're kind of like in this protective bubble that's not really the adult world. And they know they don't have really adult responsibilities, but they're away from home for the first time. And that's really amazing for them. And so they kind of live in this protective, amazing bubble. And you never have that again after you graduate from college. And I think Everybody Wants Some does a really, really great job of capturing that sense of this moment or these years in college could be the best years of your life. There's definitely something that you're never going to repeat again afterwards. And the movie is sort of imbued with this idea of what it's like to be in college, what it's like to be that free and have all these limitless possibilities, and at the same time knowing that it's not going to last. It's mostly a cast of unknowns or people who are not very well known. But among the cast, Glenn Powell, who plays one of the upperclassmen, is really, really great. But the cast is, as a whole, is really, really terrific. It's going to start expanding around the country over the next few weeks. If you like Linklater, this is probably on your list already of things you want to see. But I find this movie, it's one of the best things I've seen so far this year. And to add insult to injury, I saw this movie and then immediately had to rush to go see Batman v Superman. And I really just wanted to live inside the world of this movie for the rest of the day, but I couldn't because I had to go see Batman v Superman. And we talked about that enough in episode 10. This movie is really, really special. It's incredibly moving. It's very, very funny. I loved hanging out with these guys. Like Dazed and Confused, this movie also has a great soundtrack. But because it's 1980, you have hip-hop, you have disco, you even have punk in this. And you have this sense of a music world expanding as well in terms of popular culture and all these different kinds of strands of music kind of infiltrating mainstream America. It's really great. It's really special. I hope people like it as much as I did. I give it an A-. I think it's one of the best things Linklater has done, which is saying a lot because I love Boyhood and I love Before Midnight. So now I am going to text Will and let him know it's safe for him to come back. Don't tell him, listeners, what we talked about in terms of Everybody Wants Some.
Man, that took forever.
I apologize. Well, most half of it was speaking ill of you. You're not going to go back and ever listen to this, right?
Once I see the movie, I'll probably come back.
You shouldn't. You shouldn't. There'd be no reason for you to.
There'd be no reason. Okay. All right. So that was Everybody Wants Some! ! I don't know whether to encourage you to do what Grierson said, but I'll listen to it someday, and then I'll get to my part and be like, oh, I should have been angrier, but I wasn't. So one movie we did not review this week, but I did want to talk about because we've both seen it, was the Don Cheadle movie Miles Ahead. Now, I don't want to get too – we don't have to go too deep into it because, well, frankly, Grierson, it's not very good. And that's the reason we probably don't need to go into it too much. I saw Miles Ahead. It's one of the movies playing at the Atlanta Film Festival, as is everyone. Everybody Wants Some, unfortunately. The whole cast actually was there. They had a big red carpet here in Atlanta. Actually, I'm in Houston right now, but in Atlanta where they were. They had a red carpet for it. But Miles Ahead I saw as part of the film festival. And I have to say, I'm glad that Don Cheadle got to do this. There were many parts of Miles Ahead where it kind of felt like I like Don Cheadle. You like Don Cheadle. Who doesn't like Don Cheadle? We love Don Cheadle.
I mean, especially because this has been a passion project for such a long time.
Exactly.
In terms of trying to get the financing together. And yeah, it's something that he has really, really, really wanted to make for quite some time. Yeah.
And I will say, and I did know that going in, but that also further exacerbates the general problem with the movie, is that it kind of, first off, it's structureless and pointless and seems to have no real feel for Miles Davis as a character, except for the fact that it seems very obvious that Don Cheadle wanted to play him really badly, and so now he gets to, which gives the whole movie this sort of Make-A-Wish Foundation feel is probably the best way to put it. Is Don Cheadle, who looks a lot like, who has moments where like he seems to inhabit Miles Davis a little bit and seems to get, you know, the vibe of it, and certainly the wardrobe seems to nail it down. But I mean, this movie is Don Cheadle's performance and like nothing else.
Yeah, I don't disagree with it, which is hard because I think it actually has a really good supporting cast. I don't think they have as much to do as maybe I would like.
Ewan McGregor is like, he's got a big chunk of a role in this movie and doesn't do nothing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't pretend to be any sort of Miles Davis expert, and so I can't sort of speak definitively about in terms of how it captures his music and his world. My understanding is that they've sort of taken a lot of creative liberties in terms of, you know, not unlike, say, I'm Not There, let's say, but not quite as out there as I'm Not There is. And I think for me, the thing that was just frustrating is it just felt like, especially at a time where we are getting so many good music biopics, this one just feels a little more, it's not conventional, I'll say that, but it doesn't feel groundbreaking or risk-taking in a way that I found enveloping. I didn't find myself being kind of drawn into it. I mean, I actually think about the Andre 3000 movie of Jimi Hendrix from a couple years ago that I thought was, they actually took some real risks. I thought it was really kind of interesting in terms of creating a snapshot of Jimi Hendrix before,
without his music.
Yeah,
and
before he was famous. Right. And this movie feels a little more of the Miles Davis, he was a genius, but man, what a jerk he was. And that's a glib simplification of what the movie's trying to do. But unfortunately, I feel like, and Cheadle also co-wrote the script, that the complexities beyond that don't really resonate. And so one is left with a glib simplification in terms of walking away from the movie of thinking like, yeah, Miles Davis, genius, troubled, had to deal with racism. I mean, these are obvious facts. But to me, it didn't feel like it was, I mean, in some ways, I almost wish I didn't know this was a passion project of Don Cheadle. So I think I went in perhaps with certain expectations of oh, he's had so many years to kind of think about this, and this is what he's wanted to say for so long. I think what's hard is that the movie, to me, doesn't feel to have a deeper point in terms of what it wants to say about Miles Davis, what he represents in American culture or in jazz, or the time that he lived.
Don Cheadle just wanted to play him. Like, honestly, that's my main takeaway from the movie, is Don Cheadle really wanted to play Miles Davis. And he didn't construct a movie around that. It's just something that he wanted to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and as we said, you know, I like Cheadle a lot in general. And I like, you know, he hasn't been this sort of, like, live wire dangerous in a movie in quite some time. I mean, it feels wanting, I feel like, in terms of the movie. You know, I interviewed the actress, Emiyazi Corinaldi, who was really terrific in Middle of Nowhere, the movie that Ava DuVernay made before Selma. She's so great in that movie, and if people have not seen it, I highly recommend that. And I think that she is okay in Miles Ahead. I wish she had more to do. So I think she's really, really talented. So yeah, it's unfortunate, I think, it to have it finally come out and have it just sort of be.
Yep, there it is. All right. Well, so there's. I gave it a C. I gave it like a gentleman's C. It's like
I gave it a C as well.
All right. So I'm going to talk very briefly, very short, just because a couple podcasts ago we mentioned that probably the best reviewed and most financially successful of the movie of the week was a movie that we had not talked about. I saw Zootopia. I was very proud to report that my 4-year-old and 20-month-old sat there comfortably. They had nachos, so that helped. And that didn't make a sound throughout the entire movie. It's the first time I tried that. I saw Zootopia. That's been one of the more well-reviewed movies of the year. It's the second biggest box office hit, though Batman vs. Superman is about to pass it in. But this is a movie that your kids will not run out of the movie screaming from, much like their parents and adult critics do as well when they see Batman vs. Superman. But Zootopia is very pleasant. I won't get a big review of it, except to say I think it's very pleasant. It's very well done. Jason Bateman is very charming. Jennifer Goodwin is very charming as a voiceover in it. I'm a little baffled. I think it's a little overpraised. I think it's a perfectly fine little movie. But it's surprising to me the number of people seem to have really, really loved it. I thought it was perfectly fine and a perfect little movie for kids. So there's Zootopia. We've acknowledged you, Zootopia. Stop calling us Zootopia. We've mentioned your movie on the podcast. All right, now we're going to go to...
I'm looking forward to us talking about a movie at length now, the two of us together.
Yeah, we're just zipping. I know that we're zipping through all these movies. Next week, you'll have seen all the movies next week, and so I will have seen two of the three, so we'll be able to get into more of a debate then. But now we're to the iTunes review section of the podcast, because we still have a name.
By the way, we haven't talked about this. I actually tried this week to think, like, what would
right,
be...
Me too.
I didn't bother. I thought of this always while driving, which is a great time to be unable to look things up to see if these names exist. This is the best one I came up with. Fan favorites.
You're welcome. Fan favorites.
Fan favorites. That's the best one I could come up with. So still TBD for this name, yes.
That's a fair assessment.
Did you come up with one? Did you think
No,
of one?
No, but I don't like fan favorites. Sorry.
Yeah. Neither do I, as you can tell from my apologetic tone of announcing it. Yes.
So we're going to go to the segment that this is a little homework that both of us are going to do, Grierson. We're going to send each other a list of 10 names before the next podcast, so we've got it. And so I don't have to have, because frankly, regular listeners are like, ugh, here comes the part where they yank about not having the name yet in the podcast. Yeah. So we're not going to do that
next
week.
But listeners, I'm at least trying. Okay.
Yes,
I'm not. Come up with a name.
Yeah, good try. So we're going to go to the non-fan favorites reader review section of the podcast. We have two movies this week. We're going to start off with Shotgun Stories.
Brothers here?
What is it?
Your father's dead.
You raised us to hate those boys, and we do. And now it's come to this.
What happened?
I said some things.
You think that was wise?
Doesn't matter. Before too long, somebody's liable to get hurt, and it might be one of yours.
Anything happens to one of my brothers, I'll come after all of you.
Now, Shotgun Stories came out in 2007. It is directed by Jeff Nichols. It was recommended to us by Razor Zach. So thank you, Razor Zach. That's one word. That's not like Razor Space Zach. It's just Razor Zach. So he recommended Shotgun Stories. We just talked about Jeff Nichols, but I actually thought this would be a good example, a good time to go back and look at his first movie, because now Midnight Special, which we talked about in episode 9, is out, and is not only out, but is spread to theaters nationwide. So we thought it would be a good time to talk about his first movie. And also, you know, Grayson, we didn't really get into much on this in the last podcast, was how much, you know, you are a huge Jeff Nichols fan. And I've, again, I like Jeff Nichols, but I've always been a little bit less enamored with him as some of, like, you and some of my other friends that are critics love him a lot. I think it's just because I think Take Shelter is really good, but Mud, I think, has problems. I think it ends like 5 times. The ending of Mud is a real problem, and enough to where it made me pump the brakes on him for a little bit. Sometimes the tone can get away from a little bit. But I also think part of the reason I was not into Jeff Nichols as much as you guys are is I had never seen Shotgun Stories until now for this podcast, which is another reason I wanted to choose it. So, Grierson, you have much more experience with Shotgun Stories. So when did you see it, and what did you think seeing it again?
I actually saw it. I saw it the year it came out in 2007. It was in my top 10 that year. I've actually never seen this movie on the big screen because I actually watched it on. I got the disc from Netflix. I still remember that. So I've only seen it on television, and when I rewatched it this week, I watched it again on television. So yeah, so it's been 9 years since I had last seen it, and I sort of remember the overall plot line, but certain specifics felt brand new to me. There were a lot of things I had not remembered from the movie. Do you want me to talk about it, or do you want? I actually kind of curious, since you hadn't seen it, I almost want to hear you first, if you don't mind.
Well, one funny thing about it is I, after seeing it, I read Ebert's review. Anytime I, you know, it's I think it wasn't one of his last reviews, but certainly, you know, that was getting later on when he's not reviewing everything. I was very pleased to see that he had written about it. And one thing I'd forgotten about, I didn't realize, that it was produced by David Gordon Green, who you know, Ebert famously was the biggest David Gordon Green champion for a very long time, until David Gordon Green started doing, you know, Danny McBride comedies, which, you know, to his credit, some of my favorite episodes of Eastbound and Down were directed by David Gordon Green, certainly. But it is funny to think that there was a time, not really that long ago, where David Gordon Green was the guy who gave a chance to Jeff Nichols.
Right. And real fast, what did you think of Your Highness?
I liked Your Highness.
I was going to say, just for the record, you actually liked Your Highness. I like Your Highness. To be fair, there's a lot of Your Highness I also liked. I didn't like it quite as much as you did, but just for the record, you actually do. You are a card carrying Your Highness supporter. Yeah.
Yes,
but
so the point is worth remembering that there was a time where David Gordon Green was the great auteur, and now Jeff Nichols is probably the hottest young filmmaker we have going. So for me, I have to say I liked this as much as Midnight Special is probably, I mentioned last time, Midnight Special is probably took the lead as my favorite Jeff Nichols movie. This is close. I have to say it's really good. And one of the things I love about it too is it is, obviously it's of a place, and obviously, you know, the Arkansas that where everything takes place. It's this very desolate place where people can just sit. There's this wonderful moment where the three brothers, just to talk a little bit about the three brothers named Son, Kid, and Boy, which is, I think, was a good example of how much their father cared about them, how much he named them. They played by Michael Shannon and two other actors who I don't have in front of me. I don't remember ever seeing anything with them again. I think a couple were in Mud. I think they've been in a couple of Jeff Nichols movies since then. But they, their father, who left them when they were young, dies. They go to the funeral, and the father has, after he left them, cleaned up his act, stopped drinking, became a Christian, and raised this more successful and more, I think, maybe not more stable, but certainly happier family in their stead. And it's turned out, and he goes and causes a scene. Michael Shannon causes a scene. He basically spits on the grave at the funeral. And then we see the ramifications of actions between the two families. One of the things that I love the most about this movie is something that I think does very well also in Midnight Special, in that there is true empathy and fairness to everyone. in the movie, everybody gets a fair shake. Everybody gets a chance. Even there's a little bit, one of the brothers who ends up from the other family there's only one guy, I think, people keep telling us he's some sort of psycho or like he's dangerous or so on, but I don't know if we see that. But otherwise, everyone in this movie is generally pretty normal, acting in a reasonable way, often out of pride, often out of this male, you know, difficulty with dealing with their fathers and so on. So everything is very relatable and very fair and very sad. But one of the things I like the most about it is it's a movie about that understands pride and understands being wounded, but isn't like a slave to it. Like the idea, like this is not a slow motion tragedy where none of the characters have any autonomy over their own decisions. Like the stakes keep getting ratcheted up in this kind of revenge war between the two families, but you can sense all along that everybody would actually like to stop this. And I thought it was very realistic and extremely well done how that is constructed. He is one of the things I like about him a lot. He's such a kind of pure storyteller. Like he's clearly, you know, he has his own style, he has his own vision, but he tells a story first. And I that's something that I think a lot of your young, very heralded filmmakers, they get kind of too caught up in the other stuff. He is like a plumb, basic, cold storyteller in a way that I have to say I found kind of pure and appealing from the very beginning.
Yeah, it's a very incredibly well plain spoken movie. That's one of the things I kept thinking while I was watching it again, and I liked it just as much watching it this week. Is that it's a movie that creates a world in such an effortless way that I was actually watching it this time to think, like, how is he doing this? Like, how are the shots being put together? What is the secret to this? And the best I could kind of come up with is that there's no worry about Jeff Nichols to me does not seem like somebody who is very interested in telling regional American stories and making you notice that they're regional American stories. They're so simply done where he just sets up these like establishing shots of this kind of poverty-stricken rural Arkansas community, I think is a fair way of describing where this movie is set. But it doesn't feel like, as opposed to David Gordon Green, who I like his early movies quite a lot, even those movies had a kind of a touch of the poetic to them. There was a kind of a sense of, look how beautifully sculptured these shots are. And that really doesn't happen in Shotgun Stories. You really just kind of establishing shot. You know.
He's not a Malick dude
yeah.
at all.
Yeah, and it's funny because he has been in some ways, in certain of his movies, has the Malick comparison comes up. And I can see it a little bit, but it is funny just how much there's such a no fuss attitude.
He's very matter of fact.
He's very matter of fact. And frankly, the characters are exactly the same way. It's a movie where people talk to each other because they know each other, and there's no worry about establishing who's who and what's what. You just kind of learn it as you go. From the very first shot, when you see Michael Shannon in this movie, who plays the oldest of the three brothers of the one side, he's opening the dresser drawers in his bedroom. And there's no explanation of what that means, but don't worry, you'll figure it out. And everything in the movie is kind of the same way. It takes its sweet time to kind of develop the story. And the thing I really had forgotten is that for the first half of the movie, it really is just establishing the characters. There really isn't any kind of sense of this happens, then this happens, then this happens. And I think your point is so well taken. Well, that the movie, you don't feel the hard hand of the filmmaker imposing his will on the characters and making things be tragic because the filmmaker has to have it that way. There is such a sense that people just kind of, through their own faults, stumble into what happens in the movie. I mean, even in some ways, like the title is a bit of a feint, because it actually isn't that violent of a movie, and shotguns are actually not that important in terms of what happens. I mean, the most meaningful deaths that happen are actually off screen. You don't see them actually kind of happen.
I took the title as an allusion to the stories that they would tell as to what happened to his back.
Yeah, and I think it's actually forgotten about that.
Which is another kind of cool thing too. The idea that, because you know, one of the issues when he, because the first time you see him, he has all of these what appears to be shotgun shells, or he had at one point. He was in some sort of accident, but he has his shirt off, so people often walk around them. And what I find interesting is when you talk about the first 45 minutes of the movie, not really setting up the, I'll just setting up the characters. It's funny because the only time anyone even talks about what these people were like before you saw them are people around them that are not, they're almost like a chorus, like the people that work with them on the job. They're like, and they're sharing their stories of guessing what happened to his back.
Right.
And, oh, did you hear he ran into the, what are they? Is it the Hayes family? Is that the name of the family?
Yeah.
And you know, they move the plot forward in a side way that doesn't push it in your face constantly in a way that I, you know, the thing that we talked about a lot with Midnight Special is how confident of a filmmaker he is, just how he just trusts you. He knows what he's doing, and there's no sense of look at me at all. And what's amazing to me, even filmmakers that we love, usually the first movie has a little bit of that. Usually the first movie has a little bit of, look at me, look what I'm doing. This, he's got it cold from the get-go, and that's really kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And I think, again, I totally agree. I think, I remember when this movie came out, and I was kind of raving about it. And I think there's sort of this general feeling of, well, but there's not much to it. And I kind of feel like, I just get really frustrated with that. because that's the beauty of the movie. That there is a sense of characters living their lives in a very real, true way, and that you know that because they're not calling attention to themselves. I mean, one of the things that also really works for me in this film is that I think we all read these stories about local shootings, maybe somewhere in the Midwest or wherever, you know, four people shot up here or four people killed here. And you always kind of wonder, like, what happened? And it becomes sort of like almost like a freak show because you're so disconnected from it that it just becomes this lurid thing that you read about in the news. And I was actually thinking when I saw it back in 2007, if I had read this story in the newspaper, what would I have assumed about these people? What assumptions and prejudices and biases would I have had? And now look at this actually playing out and seeing who these people are and what they're kind of going through. Nichols is so incredibly, you know, we talk about the fairness. But I think even beyond that, there's no sense of him saying these people represent something, that they mean something because they're from Arkansas or they're from like a poorer part of the country. The movie doesn't even really kind of do that. And yet, because of the world that they live in, you can understand why they do what they do. It's very easy, I think, for people to watch a movie like this and think, well, they're not very educated. You know, there's not much money around here. So, you know, I can make certain judgments about them. But the movie really, really kind of digs deep into the characters so that you really understand them and at the same time understand why they're kind of stuck. Take Shelter is still my favorite because I think Michael Shannon's performance and also Jessica Chastain's performance in that movie is really, they're both really tremendous. But this one is really good. It's a really, really good movie. And I'm glad with Midnight Special that maybe more people will check out this movie as well.
Yeah, and the last thing I want to say about this, Michael Shannon. it's funny because, you know, he had actually been in, you know, he'd been bounced around as an actor for a while. You know, he's the year before this came out, he was in Bug. That was probably the year he emerged a little bit. You know, he was in Pearl Harbor.
I had not remembered that. But I saw that in his credits, but I did not remember that, yes.
He was in Pearl Harbor and Bad Boys 2. So he's been in two Michael Bay movies in a lot of ways. So anyway, the point is that he'd been in movies before, but like really had never busted through. But the 2006 was the year of Bug. It was the year of World Trade Center, which I think is probably the first time that people were like, whoa, who is that guy? Because he's the Marine that comes in to help. Just like off the street. It's a very famous story that Slate told. So those are the two that kind of jumped out a bit. But now, to me, we talked about, when we talked about Midnight Special, how because he is such a, you know, he's such a powerful figure that they often make him play crazies or General Zod or whatever. But he is at his best when he's playing normal people. And he is so good in this. He's so perfect as this guy who's clearly flawed And clearly has some problems and is very damaged, but is also fundamentally decent and fundamentally wants to protect his brothers against that ultimately you, even though he makes a lot of bad decisions, you are instantly and foundationally on his side. And I feel like that is something as an actor that he's just great. All right, so that is Shotgun Stories 2007. It's available for rent on iTunes and Amazon, everywhere you'd want to see it. So our second and final movie in our reader reviews. Howdy, readers. What up, gang? Whatever name. Those are all great names.
Yeah.
Section is...
Fan favorites looking better all the time, yes.
is Shattered Glass.
Why didn't you get this?
I don't know.
Do you have phone numbers for all your sources on the hack haven bees?
Did somebody let's do some kind of follow-up story?
I called all the hackers I know, asking if any had heard of a hacker by the name of Big Bad Bionic Boy. Nothing.
He's made some pretty serious charges.
This looks very suspicious to me.
I'm increasingly beginning to believe that I've been duped.
The New Republic's snobbiest rag in the business and gets completely snowed.
Have you thought about the impact this might have?
If you fire him, people will leave.
I go, Chuck, why didn't you back me up? He goes, I'm sorry, Steve. I gotta protect the magazine.
There are political considerations.
The Young Conservatives piece. Was that true?
This wasn't an isolated incident. He handed us fiction after fiction, and we printed them all as fact.
Shattered Glass came out in 2003. It is directed by Billy Ray. It is the story of disgraced journalist Stephen Glass, played by Hayden Christensen, and his how he had been basically making up stories for the New Republic. Now, of course, that would never happen at the New Republic because, well, this is the dirty secret. I haven't seen any of these movies. I'm just really, really good at bullshitting.
So wait, which character does that make me then?
you're Chloe Sevigny. Chloe Sevigny. You're just like trying to support me. Come on, you can't leave him alone right now. If you can't leave him alone, he's really upset. I'm sorry. Are you mad at me? That is my Stephen Glass impression.
Sum up our relationship. It is.
It doesn't it though. So so basically Hayden Christian plays Stephen Glass.
Well, you can't go to law school. You can't do that.
I can't go to law school. I'm under a lot of pressure now.
Sorry, go ahead.
where basically he comes into across with a new editor, Chuck Lane, played by Peter Sarsgaard, who, by the way, I'd so recently seen Peter Sarsgaard in Experimenter. Yes. That there were a couple of times I kept expecting him to talk to the camera.
There was no elephant in the background. You were confused.
Yes, exactly. But so basically, Chuck Lane, played by Peter Sarsgaard, slowly discovers just how much his they're basically star reporter, just how much water he's put them all under. So, Grayson, you loved, we both really enjoyed Shattered Glass. I think it made both of our top 10 movies of that year.
Yes, I am a big fan of this movie. Yes.
So watching it again, I will say, I did think it was very good. I still thought it was very good. I'll confess, though, the stuff that I feel like the stuff that I remember loving the most is the stuff that lands the best. But I think, like, to me, any scene where Sarsgaard is catching on and any scene where he's dressing down Christian, like, Sarsgaard is so good in this movie and such a powerful presence and such like a great, like, no bullshit journalist that who's just slowly starts to dawn on him what is going on and his ability to suss that out. Those scenes are so powerful that I'll say some of the other stuff, there are things I noticed here that I did not notice last time. There's a little bit more of a hectoring tone, hectoring, look what's happening to journalism tone in this movie that I'll confess I did not notice the first time and frankly was very happy was not in Spotlight. I think one of the things I love about Spotlight is it is about how good journalism is done, but it doesn't except take you aside and be like, just so you know, tisk, 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 you young writers. This has got a little bit of that. I had not noticed it the first time. It's got a little bit of it that I have to say I did not see the first time.
Maybe. It still doesn't bother me. I still love this movie. In terms of lists of most underrated 21st century movies, this would be pretty high on my list, I have to say. And I do understand what you're saying, and I do get it.
That could be from the original magazine article, not to bring my own personal history into that. But of course, the original magazine article was written by Buzz Bissinger. So that might, maybe that's sneaking in there a little bit.
Possibly. But.
Not my thing, his thing. Because it's in there. It's definitely in there.
I, I think this movie is really great. And I think it's great for lots of reasons. I think, you know, as you said, Sarsgaard's great in it. Hayden Christensen, I think, is actually tremendous in this movie. I don't know. I'm not sure what has happened since then. And I mean that sincerely. I don't know what has happened since then, because it's hard for me to see this movie and not think, this guy can do this.
He can do it.
And I think what is most crucial in this movie is, I think simultaneously you have to go, there's something about this kid that I don't entirely trust. And at the same time go, but I can see why other people don't see it. Because I think with a movie like this, what can be easy is to say, well, these guys were idiots. How could they not know he was doing this? And I think that Billy Ray, who also wrote the script, does it really, really well. And I think Hayden Christensen also does it really well, because there is such a ingratiatingly modest, not quite smarmy, but there's something about him that feels like, we referenced this just now when you're saying, like, are you mad at me? There's something about the way Christensen does that in the movie where you go, no, it's not that big of a deal. You just double check your notes and just make sure it's fine. Like, he seems so eager and enthusiastic and tells the stories of his pitches in the room of what he wants to do, that you legitimately go, that's a great story. This is not one of those movies where you think, well, I guess you had to kind of be there and it didn't really... I feel so like I completely understand why he was able to hoodwink all of them. And I think also what's important for me about this movie, and why I think it also is so great, is that Sarsgaard is not doing what he's doing because he doesn't like the kid per se. It's about the fact, and I'm not going to pretend that this movie is a straight recreation of what happened. I'm only going to talk about the movie. I'm not going to talk about the actual people and what happened to them. But Sarsgaard's character, what is, I think, kind of forgotten about in this movie, is that he is replacing the popular guy. And nobody likes him. And so it's not so much that Sarsgaard feels like, well, I have to get back at these guys because nobody likes me. But he, in some ways, is in the perfect and also the most unperfect position, because he actually sees the truth of what's happening. But people don't want to listen to him because they don't like him, because they blame him for firing Hank Azaria's character, who they all liked a lot more. And again, Hank Azaria's character is great because he does seem like an editor that you'd want to work for, who would have your back. I don't think you have to be like a journalism nerd or a media nerd, I think, to understand those very basic relationships of what's going on in that movie. And for me, the scenes where Sarsgaard is finally catching Christensen, where they're walking around, and it's like, show me where you were, what was happening, I find those scenes incredibly wonderfully excruciating. There is a sense of someone just melting. And I think Christensen, again, like, you just sort of feel that. It's almost like you almost kind of can't watch those scenes, but they're so beautifully done. And the way the movie even extends to the supporting characters, where Chloe Sevigny says, like, you shouldn't try to be funny. Like, it's just heartbreaking. The sense, when people talk about like the great journalism movies, they tend to mention like All the President's Men. Understandably so, it's a fantastic movie. I think people will talk about Spotlight that way. To me, this one, if it's not quite up to that level, it's a pretty darn good one, because I think it talks about what the pressures are that create a Stephen Glass, essentially. If you're in an environment where it's elite and it's prestigious and there's a sense of everybody's kind of fighting against everybody else to make it, you can see why a Glass exists. It doesn't blame the New Republic. It doesn't blame that basically saying, like, oh, it's their fault. But you can at least kind of go, I see why somebody tries to do this, to try and get ahead.
And I see that too. But the stuff that I do not think that holds up that well is the notion that, well, this, like, the opening crawl, the opening thing that you see in the credits is the average age of the reporter was 24 or 25. Like, the notion that these are all kids is something that the movie hits a little harder than I think it needs to. The idea that, well, Michael Kelly was the dad and the grown-up for everyone, and Peter Sarsgaard was not the... Like, I don't find it that... I don't find that the takeaway, any major takeaway from the story is the fact that they're young, they're kids. And that's like a major thing. The movie keeps hitting on repeatedly. Hey, they're kids. All these guys. Look at the power of these, the in-flight reading of Air Force One. But there's just kids doing it. I don't find that compelling. I think Stephen Glass would have done that if he were 45. And I think that, and so for me, that's the one part of the movie that I didn't remember hitting me that much. I still think it's a great movie, but it's the one part that I found myself getting a little bit more irritated about this movie, that I didn't remember it hitting that age thing that much. The idea that right. These kids are young. And so, and this is what happens when you give this kind of power to people that, and also the movie that keeps hitting Glass for, well, his stories are too entertaining. His stories are too flashy. And we're really just about the facts. Like, that's not... Like, the movie hints at that a couple of times in a way that I think is distracting and not really the point.
I can understand that. I don't see it that way, because for me, it's not the fact that these kids had too much power.
But it's in there. It's in there, though. It's in
there. I think what Billy Ray is trying to say is that they're so young that in some ways they're not, I don't want to say impressionable, but there's a sense of not having the perspective to know how to do their job well. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, I'm trying to think how I want to articulate this. It's like, because they're so young, they are more like kids than they are grownups. And so in some ways they're more susceptible, not that adults are not susceptible to this, but that they're more susceptible to feelings of rejection, acceptance, then in some ways it's almost like a high school for them.
But there's still that Hector notion, even in the really great scene where Sarsgaard calls out Chloe Sevigny, who tries to defend him, and he's like, no, listen, you would never let this last. You're a good reporter. You'd always call bullshit on stuff like this. But even then, he's like, we let him get away with it because he's entertaining. As if like that entertaining thing comes up like two or three times in the movie that I think is supposed to be this like quiet dividing line of like, listen, he tried too hard to be entertaining and didn't stick to, and listen, that's true. Like, I'm not saying that it isn't, but it also seems like the movie finds that more important than it's
that's fair. I'll allow that, counselor.
Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, because I think again, like, you know, whether it's Alex Gibney's documentary about Scientology or whatever there, I think there's an ease of saying, well, I wouldn't do that in that position. I would have been smart enough to know Scientology's a racket, or this Glass kid didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And I want to kind of get back to this point, because I do think that the movie shows how that environment can exist. The other thing I want to say, because I love this story, and you may know this, but you know, when I interviewed Billy Ray one time, and we talked about this movie in quite some detail, you know, he talked about the fact that initially the bookends didn't exist.
The book, you mean the story of him talking to the class?
Yeah, the stuff for the class.
Yeah. The class, so, but that's throughout.
Right, yeah, like, yeah. That
narrative.
That was...
He did that at the end?
He made the movie, wrote the movie, shot the movie. None of the stuff of him talking to a class was in there. He's like, this movie, like, it's not right. Like, there's something wrong with it. And he basically, like, told the producers, like, I need to... Can you give me a little more time and a little more money to basically like figure this out? And he hit on the idea of he needs to talk to this class that doesn't exist. And I'm kicking myself now because I actually don't have exactly what he said, so I don't want to mangle it. But I think what I think that's such an important element of the movie, because it gets to the idea, because you mentioned the thing about entertaining. I think this is important to bring up. I think that the way Billy Ray sort of conceives that movie, and I think it's completely valid and I think it works, is that there is something about the idea of he's doing it in some sort of metaphorical way because he wants to be praised. He has to be praised. He has to have that thing where his fictional old teacher carts him out and he can tell students what this stuff is like and like that. And then when they're not there, it's this idea that, number one, why were you doing it for that reason? Also, it's just another thing that he's sort of fabricating. In some ways, to me, this movie is not dissimilar to The Social Network. This idea of people who had a certain amount of notoriety and a certain amount of an idea of how to do something, but it's driven by competition and it's driven by this idea of either wanting to get back at people or wanting to be accepted in a way. And I think it's very, very strong in this movie. Because I think a lot of what's going on a lot of times in this film is people want to be liked. Stephen Glass most wants to be liked. The only character who really doesn't worry about it so much is actually the Sarsgaard character, I feel like, in a certain way. And you could argue that's partly how he's able to see what other people cannot see, because there's something very cliquish about the movie. And because Sarsgaard is not part of it, you know, that's why you kind of need to have those like dissenting voices. And I think that's sort of the testament of what that character is able to do. You know, he was nominated for an Oscar for this. I think he's great. Between this and his work in Experimenter, which of course I love, it's like Peter Sarsgaard is one of those kind of like underrated, underappreciated actors. So he doesn't have a lot of chances to have kind of great big roles, but boy, when he gets one, he is really, really, really good. I think the cast kind of up and down in this movie is really, really tremendous. So yeah,
And also, let's not forget, he's a Cardinals fan. He's from Belleville, Illinois, and he went to Wash U, so he is a Cardinals fan. That's a nice little way for us to wrap that up. And on as baseball begins this week, we are both Cardinals fans, which just made all of you that like the podcast stop listening and never listen to it again. And so for that, I apologize. All right, Grierson. That was episode 11. Next week, we are going to be back to talk about The Boss, which is the new movie from Melissa McCarthy, Hardcore Henry, which is a first-person shooter except as a movie. What?
What won't they think of next?
And then you will be talking about Ladder Than Bombs, which is the new movie by Joachim Trier. I can never say that right.
I believe that is correct. That right? Yes. Yes. Okay. The filmmaker who did Oslo, August 31st.
A movie that I love a bunch. I love that movie. But we'll be there to talk about that. And we'll also have a movie from our... We'll have a movie and we'll have a name. We're going to have it. We're going to have it next week for you, I promise. I can't promise. I'm going to try to promise. All right, Grierson. Have a great one. Be safe out there. Everyone, thank you for listening. And of course, remember to subscribe in iTunes. And please leave us a review with a name of a movie. And we'll review the movie for you. We'll be back next week.